Black men accused of raping a white woman. The men were hanged from a tower in the middle of the public square. The white woman who claimed the three black men raped her later admitted that her story wasn't true. But the damage was done and celebrated. Someone in Springfield even minted a coin.
On one side, 1906, Good Friday. And on the other side of the coin, it said, the lynching of three niggers.
In the days after the lynching, panic spread among black residents, and thousands left the Springfield area, never to return. Father Berry's family was one of the few that stayed. Racial animosity continued for decades. And so, when after years of work in Eastern Orthodox churches around the country, Father Berry decided to return to Ash Grove and open his museum, friends cautioned him.
My family friends called me here and they said, you know, you better be careful opening up a museum in that little town. White folks aren't gonna like it.
Despite that warning, he says the reception here has been warm. Townspeople even helped him clean up his family's cemetery, overgrown and almost forgotten for decades. The tombstone of his great-great-grandmother, a slave, is barely standing. Many other slaves are buried in unmarked graves here. A few years ago, Father Berry moved his family back into the farmhouse where his grandmother raised him. Nearby, he built this new church. It's no bigger than a single car garage. But within this small frame, he holds to his faith and his quest for racial harmony. In this way, Father Berry hopes to resurrect his hometown's lost heritage of black Americans.
I can look back at my ancestors and go, these guys didn't do it. They were slaves and children of slaves. And they were able to live their life and leave behind a loving legacy that people even today appreciate.
Father Moses Berry, and I live in the house that my great-grandparents built in 1871. My great-grandparents built that house, Caroline and William Berry. Their photographs are over here on this wall. I'll show you later. My great-grandparents built that house. My grandparents were born and raised in that house. My father was born and raised in that house. I was born and raised in that house. And now I'm raising my children. As I like to say, my children have flown the coop. My daughter just graduated from Mills College a few weeks ago in Oakland, California, and my son is always off on adventure. He's graduating from Ole Miss after being on expedition in Antarctica for a year. So they've flown the coop. There are no more berries there except my wife and I. I'm third generation AME pastor's son. That's African Methodist Episcopal Church. My family has been involved in that church since the very beginning. My great-grandmother is the daughter of Nathan Boone, the granddaughter of Daniel Boone, and my great-grandmother. A funny story I have to tell you. When we first moved back to the country, they asked us to come to the Boone Rendezvous. And do you know what rendezvous are? Those are places where people get together and reenact a certain portion of history. And they had the dragoons, the soldiers that Nathan Boone was a part of. And they knew that we had all these things that belonged to Nathan Boone because he was also our relative. We have Nathan Boone's gun and cabinets and quilts from the Underground Railroad that belonged to my great-grandmother and quilts that Caroline and Marie made on the Boone Plantation when they lived there before the end of the Civil War. So they asked us to come and bring some items that belonged to the Boone family. So I brought some quilts and a few other little things, that, you know, a few other items. But I bought some quilts, and I bought quilts that were made by my great-grandmother. I bought quilts that were made by my grandmother for her dowry in 1907. And I brought quilts from the Underground Railroad. And the only one I was really certain about was were the quilts from the Underground Railroad, because they had been on loan to museums all over the country. You know, even your Carnegie Mellon museum had this particular quilt there. So this is called a Drunkard's Path. So, you know, those were pretty well known to me. The other ones, I wasn't sure about. But I inherited them from my family, and I knew a little bit about them, so I lined them up. The ones that looked the oldest, I would say, belonged to my great-grandmother, and the newer ones, I would say, belonged to my grandmother. After all, who could dispute it? So I said, this one belongs to my grandmother, this belongs to my great-grandmother, and so forth. And there was a little white lady in the back of the room, and we later found out that she was 94 years old. And every time I would mention these quilts, she would say, no, don't think so. It was humiliating. Good Morning America was there. The Lieutenant Governor was there. Because this was the first time some of these items had been on public display ever. They were in our house in St. Louis. My wife and I had just moved there with the kids from St. Louis. We lived in a three-story Victorian house. And from 1907, it was a, you know, great old St. Louis house. And then we moved back to the country to a one-story farmhouse that my great-grandparents built. So we had all these things that used to be scattered out all over our house, and now they were in this little house. And this lady says, so everybody was excited to finally get to see these quilts. Because, you know, people would ask me to bring them to certain events, but I didn't want to. I didn't want to be public. I was actually sort of afraid of how people would handle my legacy, or how they would treat my family's tradition. And I was afraid also that maybe people would just sort of not respect it to the degree that I knew that some of these items were due, because they were connected to people who suffered and died in this country. So, this was a big deal, and this little lady was ruining my presentation. And every time I would say something, she'd say, no, don't think so. Finally, she said, why don't you stop lying? It was humiliating. The Lieutenant Governor was there, because they wanted me to open up this museum called the Dred Scott Museum in the capital, in Jefferson City, the capital of Missouri. So they were trying to court us, you know. And I said, what do you mean, ma'am? And she said, well, I won't tell you. And I said, well, how do you know? And she said, because they taught me how to quilt. As it turns out, this lady's mother came across the Cumberland Gap in 1890 in a covered wagon. And my grandmother was the daughter of a slave. So they were contemporaries who lived in this little town of Ash Grove, and they loved each other. And when she finally finished saying all that, she said, gotcha, because she was just giving me the business the whole time. And it worked. I'm glad that she did. She said, this quilt was made by your grandmother. This quilt was made by your great-grandmother. This was from the Underground Railroad. I knew that. And this was from your great-grandmother, from the Boone Plantation. I knew that, too. And then she began to tell me all about my family's history. And I was with her. I had the opportunity and pleasure to be with her when she died, just only 2 years ago. So, this particular quilt is part of the Underground Railroad. I'm sure you all know about the Underground Railroad, right? And they had certain quilts that they used that were called telling quilts. And they weren't quite as esoteric as some people make them out to be these days. But they had encrypted codes in there that taught the slave how to escape from captivity in the South to freedom in the North. This particular one was called a drunkard's path. And if you've ever seen a drunkard going down the road, he's sort of staggering around, you know. And this was for the slaves to follow the staggered path, or the most indirect path, the prescribed indirect path. We'll come back to these items, these quilts in the Underground Railroad in just a little bit. But since I'm speaking about the Underground Railroad, I want to talk a little bit about the effort that we as a nation have made in order to bond together. You know, we have done this, we made this act together. The white people provided, as you know, the safe houses for the slaves to take refuge in, and the slaves were the ones, come in children, come in. And the slaves were the ones who took refuge in the safe house. Come in, come in, come in. No, it's okay. Bring the kids in. I want them to see something here. So at any rate, so you can see we've made effort together. We want to make sure that we continue to do that because as the great poet, the great African-American poet who I was raised on, Paul Laurence Dunbar, when he spoke about the party. You familiar with Paul Laurence Dunbar? Do you know the poem, The Party? It was about these seven plantations that got together. Thank you. They got together and they had a big celebration, you know, and all the slaves came there for this celebration, and they had all kinds of things to eat that he names off in this slave dialect. That's how it's written. Some of his poetry is written that way, and some, you know, it's not. But this is in slave dialect, and they had slaves from seven plantations, and they had all kinds of food, and everybody had their fill. And then after they finished eating, the fiddler got up so, quote, they could dance that dinner down. You know, in other words, they could help that, you know, settle the food, you know. And then he goes on to say, and the saints and the sinners were so mixed up on that floor that I'm sure that Gabriel could not have separated them if the trumpets had chanced to blow. So you see how much we are bound up as human beings, such a simple poem as a Paul Laurence Dunbar's poetry. You can see how we're all bound up with one another. My great-grandfather, Wallace White, was the first black man in the Missouri State Cavalry. They fought at Vicksburg. This is a picture of my great-grandfather and his wife, Daisy, outside of their canebrake. I would have had more pictures to bring you, but, you know, on our house, they had an archaeological dig on our property. And they just finished up Thursday. And I was running like crazy to get here by Friday. But they just finished this archaeological dig because we have a safe house on the furthest end of our property. And they used some of those pictures for the newspaper, but I'll share the article with you, with Father, and he can, you know, maybe be sure that everybody has a copy of that. But anyway, Wallace White was freed from a field in Kentucky by the Missouri 5th Cavalry. He was 14 years old. At that time, they had a system that I like to refer to as the honor system. I'm sure it wasn't called that, but I call it the honor system. And the slave in the morning, come help me. The slave in the morning would go to the field and put on his slave chains. And in the night, he would come home and take them off. Because that's how you really make a slave. You know, because it's not enough just to seduce a person and make them obey your will. You know, it takes more than that. You have to get their mind. You have to break the spirit. And so that was one of the methods that they used. They would put their own neck irons on and they'd go to the fields and they'd come back in the evening. So it was sort of it was terror. These are my great grandfather's neck irons. They go on like this. You saw in the movie. It almost takes my breath away when it's on. This goes like that. And this goes through here like this. And this goes through here like this.
And these are called walking ball and chain. And they go through this little hoop around the neck there, and that's how they transported the slaves. These were mean instruments that held the slaves captive. But they were also means by which their souls could soar. They did soar. They had the possibility of soaring. Because they were no longer citizens of this world. They were citizens if they had faith and hope and took advantage of the grace of God that was given to them. They had the possibility of being citizens of the world to come. You know, and sometimes I'm sort of envious. They had no hope in this world. And I've got all kinds of hope in this world. I hope my plane is on time. I hope when I get back to the airport, my car starts. You know, I hope that the kids, you know, everything turns out with the children. I'm always afraid for them. You know, because you know, they're so smart and so handsome, and I was neither of those when I was growing up, and so I don't think anything's going to work out for them. And so I've got all kinds of hope in this world, which is exactly the opposite of what I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to have hope only, not only in this world, but in the world to come. And I'm supposed to have faith. So sometimes I'm a little envious of them. I wouldn't want to trade places. Although, you know, I do sort of envy that sort of possibility of, you know, making yourself a slave. These chains were not these walking ball and chains weren't to completely stop a person, but to slow down their mobility. This is my when we got married, my wife and I got married. My wife, and Esther was our bridesmaid. His friend from Oregon, his priest's wife. My mother gave us this lock. This belonged to my great grandfather. It's called a screw lock. Have you heard someone say to another person, "Screw you" or "get screwed"? You heard the term. It's actually a Civil War term that means someone's going to get locked up, because the padlock of choice from around 1810 to 1920s was called a screw lock, and you screw it in, and the lock comes open. You screw it out, and this becomes the key, and this becomes the padlock. Thus the term screw you. And even in some circles, which I'm sure you don't travel in, they still refer to the jailers as screws. You've heard that? You've heard people say that before. In those old James Cagney movies, when he refers to those jailers, he says, "You dirty screws." That's because that's why. It's because of the padlock. So now, when the children come to the museum, I say, "Now, the next time you hear someone say that word, now you know what it means, and they have no idea." In our museum, we have a particular quilt called a Dresden plate. And, you know, all quilts have patterns. And this quilt is called the Dresden plate. And the Dresden plate is named after Dresden, Germany, which was very famous for its porcelain plates. There are also two stops on the Underground Railroad, Dresden, Ohio, and Dresden, Ontario. And when the slave would see that quilt, they would know that they would start to go toward the prescribed route, which would lead to Dresden, Ohio, or Dresden, Ontario. I had the occasion to be there most in 2007 in Lorain, Ohio, the 98th stop of the Underground Railroad. And that's where they were unveiling the statue to Josiah Hansen. Have you heard of Josiah Hansen? Josiah Hansen is the real Uncle Tom. He's the character that Harriet Beecher Stowe loosely based her character on from Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it was a very powerful book. Very powerful. So powerful that it aided in ending the Civil War. Now, have you ever heard someone else call another person Uncle Tom? Have you heard that expression? Do you know what it means? It means that they've never read the book. Because if they had read the book, they would know that Tom was far from being a sellout. As a matter of fact, Simon Legree's men beat him till his bones were bare. but he never revealed the hiding place of Simon Lemuel's mistress. So in fact, if someone were to call another Uncle Tom, the proper response would be, thank you very much. So Toni Morrison and I had we had this presentation. That's where Toni Morrison is from, is Lorain, Ohio. So where Oberlin University is near there. It's a great, great town. If you ever get a chance to visit, I think you would really love it. I went to the cemetery there because it's one of the oldest and most beautiful public cemeteries in African American cemeteries in the country. Of course, ours is an old one too. It's on the National Historic Sites Registry. It's dedicated to slaves, Indians, and paupers. We have 3 Osage Indian mounds there because we're only 7 miles from the Trail of Tears. And the Native Americans would come off the Trail of Tears and they would end up in our area. But back to Oberlin. And when I was there, you know, there were a lot of older people who wanted to come and look at some items that I had there, some particular kind of quilts that they're too fragile for me to usually travel. But since these old black ladies asked me to bring it, I had no choice. And they're made of waxed cotton and silk. And so I brought this doll from my grandma's dowry in 1907. And this dowry, this doll is called a mammy doll. Have you heard that expression, mammy? You know, mammy is a West African word, which means matriarch. So mammy's not one of those bad words. It's one of those words that's fallen into the wrong usage. But to be a mammy, you really have to be something. You don't get to be a mammy just because you're old. All you get is just to be old. To be a mammy, you have to be long-suffering. Do you remember that song at the end of this DVD when maybe you couldn't understand what that man was saying? Because it's an old Fields recording that was made by Alan Lomax for the Smithsonian Institute. But what he's saying is, oh, charity, charity suffers long. Oh, charity, charity suffers long. Oh, charity, charity suffers long. If you ain't got charity, you ain't got nothing at all. So this is what a mammy does. So in other words, you don't get that just because you are aged. It's a characteristic, something. It's a virtue. And I was showing this doll, telling these old ladies that they were so happy, And I said, well, this is Taddy. This is Hand Taddy, and she's on her way to the National Doll Museum in Washington D.C. because we've got to clean up a little bit, she has to be done right. And I said, this is Hand Tatting, and it's a little bit like lace. And these old ladies got up and they said, it's nothing like lace. It's nothing like lace. I said, oh dear, I'm in trouble. They always get me, So she said, it's nothing like lace. She said, and I said, well, okay, right. She said, and don't call it lace. And I said, all right. And then she told me how they use this little thing, device to make tatting. And it was a good lesson. This is called a mammy doll. And, this is the other side. This is the side that has to be cleaned with the Smithsonian. Do you sew? No. This is called butterfly tat. It's tatted on this side and on this side. So this is an overkill for a doll. You know, this is a decorative piece. You can look at these other things too. This is a beautiful piece. And so, mammy. So the next time you hear someone say, mammy, just think to yourself, aha, maybe if you're a woman, maybe I would like to be someday a mammy. That means you have to start getting to work on yourself. You have to start learning how to, to turn away from evil and do good. And be a blessing to everyone that you meet. My great-grandmother made this quilt. And they think they found one of her shoes just the other day, in this archaeological dig. They found a woman's shoe. It could have been the neighbor who lost her shoe. They found a shoe at this dig. And this is one of the quilts that she made. This is a quilt called A Double Wedding Ring. And this is made before the end of the Civil War. This This is a quilt top. You know, a quilt has a top and a bottom. And this is not the way that they make the new double wedding rings. This is the way that they used to make the, it's the old-fashioned double wedding ring, which is made from, they're all pieces. They're not appliqued onto, onto a larger piece. These are all single pieces. And from here to here are 11 pieces. And they're all perfect. And so I'm going to show this to you so I can explain what I mean by it. So I asked myself, why would a slave take such time to make these perfect stitches when you wouldn't even see them? They have to be pretty good or it wouldn't hold together, but they don't have to be like this. People from all over the country, all over the world come to our museum to look at this quilt because it's the perfect quilt top. And they come from Japan, from everywhere to look at this quilt. And I say that the mark of a good slave is not to please your master. The mark of a good slave is to please God and to please yourself. Because no one was ever going to see these stitches if she finished it, you know. No one would ever know that those kind of stitches existed. So that's why they're so rare, because people have taken apart old quilts and they say, nice stitches, but this one, we don't know how she did it. But they're just absolutely, well, some people know how she did it. But they can't do it. So that's the mark of a real slave, is not to please your master. The mark of a real slave is to please God and to please yourself. And when I was once, and I went to an island called Spruce Island in Alaska once with my godson, and we decided that we wanted to go there, and we went in February. Don't go in February. But we went in February and we were out there and it was so, so beautiful. And then it began to snow. And snow and snow, and we couldn't get off the island. Because the place where the boat would land, there was no way for them to know exactly where the shoreline was, because they would sort of breach the boat onto the shore and then they would push off the shore. They didn't know where to do that. So we were there, and so we went back to the church, and they were singing something, and I recall the song that they were singing. They were saying it was a song to Jesus' mother, and they were asking Jesus' mother. They first of all, let me set the stage for the song that they sang. They were talking about Jesus' mother, and they were saying, I'm going to interpret what they said a little bit. They said, since you were Jesus' mother, and you know all about him, and you have taken care of him when he was a little boy, and we know that you listened to him, we know that he listens to you. After all, he did a miracle before his ministry even began because you asked him to. So we're going to say to you, hasten, we pray, and save thy slave. That's always made quite an impression on me. That hasten, we pray, and save thy slaves. The church looks upon Mary as being our absolute prayer partner. People always ask me, Father Moses, please pray for me. I mean well, but sometimes I forget. Maybe I mean well, but sometimes I forget. And sometimes it just goes right by. But I think that we have a brothers and sisters who are in heaven, who are around the throne of God. We are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, and some of those witnesses have names. And so we have our supreme prayer partner as being Jesus' mother, because she knows all about it, changed his diapers, the whole thing. Saw him crucified, wept for him at the foot of the cross. And he said, well, don't worry, Mom, at the very end, my disciple will take care of you. Nothing to worry about. So that's why You know, this hasten, we pray, and save thy slaves was the cry that not only we sing out to the Mother of God, but that the slaves sang out to God Almighty. Hasten, we pray, and save thy slaves. There were three indicators. There were three indicators of a safe house that I will speak about this morning. There are probably many more. One was a lantern in the window. You've seen that symbol before, haven't you? The other one was a quilt draped over a banister. That would be one of those telephones. You know, these modern historians, both black and white, you know, have tried to, you know what oral history is? When oral history involves the people's experience, and the things that we tell our children, and that our parents have told us, and that their parents told them, and it's still alive. We keep it alive. And you know, we have these modern revisionist historians who say that some of the that the slaves could not have had such such sophisticated ways of communicating with one. As a matter of fact, it was probably just haphazard. But it was more than that. These were most intelligent people. I'm going to get off the subject and come back to it. I was in St. Catharines, Ontario, a few years ago, and I was talking to different churches there. And then I went to. They said, "Well, it's time for us to have a day out." And so we went to St. Catharines, BMA, British Methodist, BME, British Methodist Episcopal Church. And that's one of the churches that Harriet Tubman used to raise money at for the Underground Railroad. And her podium was there. And she would sit in front of that podium and preach and ask people for money for the Underground Railroad cause. And there was a young African-American woman who was the tour guide there. Actually, her family owned the building. You know, it just came to them some way. It's a national site. And I think they get some sort of support from the government there, but her family owns the building. She's a nice young college student, and she was the tour guide. And I said, "Oh my goodness, Harriet Tubman's podium, it's a relic." And there were these priests with me, and they started making a little chuckle. Because you know, in the Christian tradition, there are holy relics. There are items that hold sanctity, because they've been touched by saints, such as Paul's handkerchief and so forth. Even the chains of St. Peter, which you know, and all these things that exist, and even the very bones of the saints, which held sanctity. And I said, it's a relic. And they laughed, and she said, "What do you mean?" I said, this is a relic from Harriet Tubman, because she preached her sermons on there, and she cried her tears, and I'm sure, and she sweat on there, and she had hopes that, and she looked in the crowd maybe, and she saw a benefactor, and maybe she made eye contact with him, and hoped that he would be sympathetic toward her cause. And so I think this was a relic, and the girl was so moved. She was a Christian, and she became one. She said, "Oh, I'm so moved." And I think she's in the Anglican church in that town. And she said, "Oh my goodness, thank you for telling me that." She had the maintenance guy come and cut me a little piece off the bottom of that podium. It's in our museum. So nice. So, anyway. So I told you I would come back to this Underground Railroad part. There were three indicators of a safe house. Now, how's our time holding up, Father? What schedule should we be on?
Do you want to take a break, Father?
I don't necessarily want to. Do you want us to take a break?
How do you feel?
Okay, I'll tell you. We'll we can take one. I'll let you can say, or else I'll forget my thoughts. There are three indicators of a safe house: quilt, lantern in the window, and the third one you'd probably never guess. It was a little lawn jockey. Have you seen those little lawn jockeys? I used to hate those little lawn jockeys when I was a boy, because they were always black, the color of this robe, with big red lips and big old white eyes, and it was just, they were insulting. And little did I know that they were indicators of a safe house during the Underground Railroad period. And if it had a green ribbon on the arm, that meant that it was safe for the slave to approach the safe house. If it had a red ribbon on the arm, that meant stay away, the house is being watched. It even had loftier beginnings than that. Do you know this great painting of George Washington crossing the Delaware? That was for the Battle of Trenton. On the other side of that river, they were to have met them a group of soldiers called the Groomsmen Corps, who were black soldiers that George Washington had established to take to the horses. But would they be there? It was such a bitterly cold night, as the picture indicates, that icicles hanging off their beards. It was a very cold night. But would they be there? And as they got closer to the point of rendezvous, they saw the lantern. And they said, yay, our guys are there. Good, good. And then they got closer, and they realized, oh my goodness. It was young Jocko, one of the 12-year-old children of one of the groomsmen. Did I tell you that they were black soldiers? One of the 12-year-old children and one of the groomsmen that George Washington had established to take care of the horses. And he had frozen to death, holding that lantern. George Washington was so moved by that act of steadfastness that he ordered a bronze statue made in the likeness of Jocko. To this very day, it sits on the lawn of Mount Vernon with an inscription that says, "To Jocko, the steadfast young soldier." So the next time you see a lawn jockey, don't be scandalized. If you want to be embarrassed about something, be embarrassed about the paint job. Because they really were, they were terracotta. They were clay. You know, Alfred Woodard had some original ones. I almost bought original ones. I didn't have the $7,000 on them. Man, by the time I could go get rounded up, it was gone. But anyway, you know, They were terracotta. And we live in the farm, and we have young children that come, young godchildren. They're like hip, you know, the dreadlock hair and the handsome people. And they came down to the museum, my godson Patrick and my goddaughter Theodora. And so they came down to the museum. He's a filmmaker. He was the Cannes Film Festival. He won for this movie called Reconciling Rwanda. It's at your local store. So Patrick came to the house and he said, and he saw that lawn jockey, because I went out and bought one, and put a red, a green ribbon on the arm, and painted it, you know, sort of, I took some primer paint, spray paint, so it would look like clay. And Patrick says, "Father Moses, why do you have this thing in your yard?" He said, and I said, "Well, what do you mean, Patrick?" I'd only found out the week before, you know. And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, look at his lips, they're so big." And I said, "Yeah, Patrick, just like yours." And he said, "But his nose is all flat." And I said, "Yeah, just like mine, Patrick." And then, of course, he's my godson, so I could take advantage. I said, "Well, Patrick, perhaps when we are so upset, maybe we're not reconciled with our own humanity. Because there's nothing wrong with the way he looks. I mean, he looks just like a regular black man, black boy. It's the paint job." And Patrick said, "Oh, thank you very much." I said, "Let that be a lesson to you, young man." You have to teach the children anywhere we can, you know. This picture of my great-grandfather's cabin right there in the corner is still standing. And it's not quite standing like that. This was taken in the 40s, but it's still standing. And we're hoping to get some sort of a grant to help, you know, to properly restore the building. So now we can take a little break. We'll take a little 5-minute break, you think?
That's good.
Or a little bathroom break, and then we'll come back and.